We've got a number of good questions. I don't know if we're going to be able to get through them. First off, Dr. Fitzgibbons, do you find that there to be a problem with the studies on PrEPs, that those studies with chlorhexidine used had alcohol with them, but the iodine-based ones did not use alcohol? Is it a problem with the formulations?
Well, there is some studies that do compare the alcohol with the I don't think I found too many in abdominal wall, and that's why I didn't include some. But there are plenty of studies out there that compare the chlorhexidine alcohol and with provodone iodine alcohol, and it's still not quite as good as chlorhexidine.
Okay. And do you use antibiotic solutions to irrigate out your hernia repairs prior to closure?
We do not use topical antibiotics.
Okay. The solution to dilution is, or solution to pollution is dilution?
Well, in the dirty cases, but okay. Outside of that, I'm of the philosophy that macrophages can't swim.
Okay. White cells can't. Do you use prophylactic antibiotics for elective cholecystectomies?
Yes, it's part of our timeout. Everybody gets a dose of cephalosporin. It's just part of we can't get it out of the system.
Okay. The other two panelists?
Pretty much, yeah, just one dose.
Okay. Thyroidectomies?
No, not thyroidectomies.
Okay. And then what about large umbilical hernias?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then would you put mesh in at the time of an elective lap chole on a large umbilical hernia?
That comes up quite a bit, and we do. We gram stain the bile. If there's no organisms, we go ahead and just do an abdominal wall reconstruction.
Okay. Others?
Yeah, I have. I haven't actually cultured the bile to make that decision. If I think that the patient may have some high risk of having bacteria, elderly, obviously if they've got common duct stones or something like that, I wouldn't do it then.
Okay.
Where it comes up a lot is that you do the CT, you find the gallstones, and you're going to put this huge piece of mesh, like I showed in some of those videos. The last thing you want to do is have to go back in the belly.
Yeah.
So we take them out prophylactically.
Okay. This is a question to everyone on the panel. When you get infected Marlex mesh in one of your hernia repairs and you're having to take it out, how much do you take out? All of it? Part of it? How do you determine?
I take out as much as I can. So sometimes you can't take it out. You can't take all of it out. It's really ingrained because sometimes just part of it's infected. That comes out easy, but the part that isn't infected is usually impossible to get out. It's just completely ingrained.
It gets ingrained, but then you always leave that edge.
Yeah.
And do you just keep on coming back and nibbling at it?
I think if you can get it
start spitting on
it. I think if you cut back to pretty healthy tissue, usually it'll heal.
Yeah. Okay. Dr. Kroesch, you had a number of good comments about the colon injuries and all. Do you auto-transfuse cell saver blood on a colon injury?
No.
And if not, why not?
I think they've done that experiment of injecting E. coli directly into the bloodstream. Those patients
cool.
Do poorly.
Yeah.
We don't use it. The truth is, we don't use Cell Saver very much at all because two reasons. One is you don't really know what you're going to find, and two, because we're too lazy to set it up. I mean, we can dance around it, but that's basically what it comes down to. I know there's some small studies that have said it's safe to use the auto transfuser with hollow organ injury. I'm a big believer in sort of pushing the envelope, but I'm not that big of a believer in pushing the envelope.
Okay. When it comes to increasing the instance of VAP, are PPIs a problem?
No. Years ago, there was a big deal about using antacids and altering the pH. I think the main problem with the antacids, you had to give so many of them, you had to give them so frequently that every now and then people would aspirate and they would get pneumonia. When H2 blockers came about and we started giving people cimetidine, the thought was that by altering the pH that you were going to increase overgrowth of stomach flora, of gastric flora, And then since everybody had an NG tube because they were in the ICU, so therefore they had to have an NG tube in, that you would wind up with increased incidence of pneumonia. And we actually studied that, and it didn't really work. I mean, it didn't change pneumonia. So it didn't matter whether you were on cimetidine, sulcrophate, it just didn't matter. If you're going to get pneumonia, you got pneumonia, and it really had nothing to do with the gastric pH. It sounds good in theory, but it didn't pan out.
That was very popular many years ago, right?
Yeah. But among the boomers, that was pretty popular. Yeah.
So it's also prophylaxis part of the bundle, though. So
yeah, it still is. And again, I think that's just a marker of good of providing good nursing care. Because yeah,
that's a boomer bundle, actually.
Yeah, that's a boomer bundle, yeah. Okay. Dr. Kroesch, why is it called the Elvis Presley Memorial Medical Center?
Well, when the place was... In Memphis, we pride ourselves on... There's the city of Memphis, and it resides within Shelby County. So we pride ourselves in the efficiency of having two separate governments that both govern the same people. So we have a city mayor and we have a county mayor that govern the same people. There's a few extra people that live in the county, but not that many. So that's the background. When the trauma center was a big giant hole in the ground, then both mayors were sort of jonesing to have the name, have the place named after them, because they were mayors and they thought something should be named after them. Well, that was right about the time that Elvis allegedly died in the late 70s. And so people were still, the two mayors were jockeying for position, and right about then the International Elvis Presley Fan Club came and said, "We'll give you $10 million if you name the place after Elvis Presley." Well, in the late 70s, $10 million was a lot of money. So we named the place the Elvis Presley Memorial Trauma Center. So the place was named that. The city was outraged. How can you name this after Elvis Presley? And the mayors were mad, and everybody was very unhappy about it. It turns out it was very good for us because it gave us instant notoriety, right? Everyone's heard of Elvis Presley. Didn't matter where you were. Oh, you're from the Elvis Presley Trauma Center. Well, the problem is they only came up with about 600,000 of the 10 million. But by then it was already named, so we couldn't really change it. Now, we don't get a penny from Graceland. We don't get a penny from anyone. Interestingly, early on, Graceland wanted to be part of it. They wanted to be associated with the trauma center. And again, it's like you had to fail a test to be a hospital administrator. So they said, no, absolutely not. We don't want any part of this. They were still annoyed that we named the place the Elvis Presley Trauma Center. And so now Graceland makes millions of dollars a year, and we squander in oblivion. But I will say, and this is a true fact, and this can win you, you know, an adult beverage in a trivia contest, the Elvis Presley Memorial Trauma Center remains the only freestanding building in the world named in honor of the king. There you have it.
You got that going for you.
That's which is nice.
Which is nice.
That's how it was named.
Okay. To the panel, is there such a thing as a generational transformationalist? Somebody who grew up in one generation but now has all the characteristics of a subsequent generation. They actually, a boomer that knows how to do Facebook, Twitter,
a boomer
Wikipedia.
That smoked a lot of pot in his time, yeah. I think, maybe.
Well, I sold my minivan, you know, just the VW bus that has the flowers and stuff on it. Now, you know, I think supposedly, and you know, this one of the reasons I had that sort of disclaimer at the beginning is that I'm not an expert. I read a lot and I looked at a lot and I interviewed my own kids and figured out what it was that they did that I didn't do or they wanted me to do or whatever. But supposedly, the social scientists say that as you grow up, you are very much influenced during that critical time. Which is kind of late adolescence, young adulthood, where many of your views are set. Now, it's not integrity and things like that. That's set, you know, all along and early on. But a lot of your views that then match people of your generation occur. And there are some people that are sort of out of context in their own generation, sort of belong to a different one. And there are cuspers, as I've learned, people who sort of sit on the edge and have traits of both. But interestingly, they say that if you start one way, you kind of stay that way. Now, that doesn't mean your political views. You know, many people in high school are very liberal, and as they get older, they may get more conservative. At least that's what you read. That's a little different thing, but your makeup, your thought, your what drives you, a lot of that sort of stuff seems to be consistent throughout much of your career. Now, as people, I mean, in my own generation, are evolving, there's no question that this get up really early, work all day at the office, stay late, get home late, and come home sort of feeling like you've won the lottery because you worked harder and spent longer than anybody else at work, that people are starting to figure that's wearing a little thin. And so I think things will evolve, but the whole boomer group is evolving kind of that way. So, at least according to the social scientists, you kind of fit in that group. There are some things that change, yes, and not everybody fits in one group. There's one of the surgeons who says, "Geez, I was born at a different. I was born later than you, but I think I have thought process like some other guys, you know." And so there are people who have characteristics that don't fit exactly within that, but. That's at least what the experts that have written those books say. I'm just reporting on it.
Okay. Other questions for the panel? Yes.
Well, you have no choice but to leave them open at that point. Usually we use an AbThere device. That's the most popular one. And then try to reclose them once the edema settles down. Well, you almost have to use some type of bridging technique, which probably is not going to work, but when you come back later, if you have to, it's going to be a lot easier.
Yes?
What is your average time on those huge measurements?
About 5 to 6 hours. And it's, you know, in fact, I left one slide out of my presentation, a cynical slide, and it shows the reimbursement for ventral hernia repairs in the state of Nebraska according to RVU system, and it's about $700. And it doesn't make any difference whether you have a hole this big you put two stitches in or whether you spend 6 hours, you know. But fortunately, with this component separation business, we can use those codes and at least sort of justify spending that much time in the OR.
Less than the plumber's.
Pardon me? That's right.
Yeah, you're right.
That's why I said I have a huge referral practice, and that's why the surgeons out in Nebraska, Jerry Seiler out here, doesn't want to fix these kind of hernias. He's sitting out here in the audience. Yeah.
Dr. Patel?
So when you explant the effective piece of mesh, how long do you wait before you do it?
I didn't hear that.
If you explant the mesh, how long do you wait before you go back?
Oh, yeah. I think that's the biggest mistake that I see in my practice where surgeons go back too quickly. Never before 6 months. Absolutely never before 6 months. And if MRSA is involved, never before a year. Yeah. And take them all to a year if you can, because you'll just get another infection if you take them back too soon. And plus, the tissue stay edematous for at least 6 months. So never before 6 months.
Never in a hurry for those.
Yeah. If you explant the mesh, well, a lot of times you don't even need to use anything. They're all stuck in there.
Just close the skin.
Yeah, just close the skin and accept the hernia. And then if there's not enough skin, then you can just let it granulate and skin graft it.
Yes, up here.
Yes.
My husband's a systems engineer, and he does a lot of work in different countries with a lot of conference calls. And one thing I've noticed observing him and talking to him about is the striking difference in attitudes between
You know, when people, again, in the research that I reviewed, I think the generational differences are, there probably are some and maybe more extreme across different parts of the country. But, you know, across the entire United States, that's a good deal more homogeneous within each group than you would see comparing millennial age here versus millennial age in India or someplace like that. There's no question that generational differences exist in other parts of the Western world. I honestly didn't see anything written about, you know, China, Japan, India. I think most of those places that have wide communication across all of the population, such as TV, social media, et cetera, probably reflect what we see in this country more, as opposed to those that have much more limited interaction at that level.
Do you see any difference in your residents? That's where my question is.
Oh, I see what you mean.
I mean, he sees some differences in his work, in the people he works with, and accommodates based on that. Do you see any differences in the residents?
Well, we only take boomer attitude millennials at Mayo. You know, that's a good question. There are clearly differences, I think, between people across different parts of the country. I'm not sure exactly if I am able to categorize that according to generational changes as opposed to sort of attitudes that may be a little bit different, maybe integrated into that, but that are sort of East Coast versus West Coast, Midwest, South, you know, even Memphis.
That's crazy.
Dr. Fitzgibbons?
I just want to close the loop on the breast since we haven't any breast questions. We heard in the presentation that they were doing this partial mastectomy first and then the sentinel lymph node biopsy. I always thought that was heresy. Do you have to use separate gowns and gloves and instruments when you do that, or is it okay to do the cancer operation first and then go to the axilla? Did I hear that right? I think I heard it right.
We have not changed the question. Let me repeat the question for those who didn't get it. If you are doing a sentinel node, are you talking about after neoadjuvant or just regular?
Regular.
Just regular. We have not changed gloves and that sort of thing when we're doing the lumpectomies and sentinel nodes, but I've always, you know, we have always done the sentinel node early, and so I've almost always done the sentinel node first, and part of the reason for that is that we have immediate frozen section available, and that often will help us decide what we're going to do at that same time. So that may be a reflection of that, and then we do the breast procedure after that. So we don't change it because at worst we'd be taking cancer to cancer, yeah, or benign to cancer rather than opposite.
Okay. No other questions? That concludes the symposium for today. We'll see everybody in the morning. Thank you very much to our panelists.